Hey everyone, welcome to the last afterthoughts and the last episode of The Complex. Before we start into the discussion of episode 6, I want to briefly tell everybody that make sure that you stay subscribed to this channel because we're not sure what could potentially happen in the future. Maybe there's a season 2, maybe there's more kind of, James is calling them shiny shorts.
Who knows what comes of this wonderful mind of mine.
Tidbits of information and things like that, or potentially a season 2. So keep your eye out for that. That might be in development in the next coming year or so.
Yes, and I'm sure I haven't thought of 4 or 5 things already.
I'm sure
in this
not.
Wonderful mind of mine, but we'll just keep people entertained.
So stay tuned for that. For this episode of Afterthoughts, we'll be discussing, obviously, episode 6, which was kind of the big culmination of everything coming together. That's both in the sense of learning about my background, Jules' background in the complex,
right.
And also learning about pretty much the ultimate tool for ADHD. That's at least kind of what it seems like, which is imagination.
Oh, yeah. My shiniest of objects.
Yes. So I want to explain a little bit more about the idea of imagination. Where did you first come across this? Like, how did you come to the realization that this could be something useful that ADHD people can use?
Well, it's a great question because I will tell you after, again, almost 30 years of working with this, this isn't what I would have anticipated that I'd be talking about the powerful space of imagination. But it really came to be in the mid-90s, okay, when I had started educating those with ADHD about how it sets up in their mind, personalizing strategies. We were doing really good work, and I was starting to treat the trauma or the distress of it. And it was at that point that it wasn't going away. And I thought to myself,
something has to be happening.
Yeah, something's got to be happening. Yeah. So in my own explanation or exploration and wondering about natural resources we had, it's probably the easiest way to think about it. I kind of stumbled upon the idea of imagination and began to wonder, I wonder if that could be used to help with the stress of ADD. In my research on it, you know, I had, at that point, certainly people were using it as visualization for performance in sports or speaking or the arts.
Well, right. Yeah, because I've actually heard that before, that if you're in sports or if you like play soccer or something like that, if you imagine yourself playing or like, you know, going through dribble skills and like building up all these different like practices in your mind, not physically doing it, you still reinforce those neural nets, and the next time you practice, you're actually a lot better than what you would have expected.
Exactly. And so they've had some very interesting research on that. Like one of the ones people may know about, it you can look up pretty quickly, is shooting free throws in basketball and people visualizing that versus actually practicing it.
Yeah.
And the people visualizing actually did better.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Then those who practiced it.
Right.
Okay. And so the idea of visualization in your mind was powerful. And it really was kind of a shiny idea of like, I wonder if we could use this on the stress of ADD because it's a natural resource.
Yeah.
It's something we, you know, purpose. We have it. Yeah. We have it. Everyone has it naturally. I wonder how I could use this. And then that's where I created the ideas of the internal worlds in your imagination.
Mm-hmm.
Really, it has. So that idea has been a powerful resource in psychology or guided meditation.
Like
or
emotional safe places?
Yeah. And so the idea of guided in your imagination has been used for a long time. But I thought, what if you really created your own internal world that you kept and you revisited and you developed?
Yeah.
Is that not so?
Is an emotional safe place classically kind of different than that in a therapeutic sense?
Not really. Classically different in that the ideas of developing it in your imagination are the same.
Yeah.
It's the consistency of use. It's okay. Development over time in a way that's meaningful to you.
So it's the personalization.
Correct.
Of it. Yeah.
And it's the maturing, as I'll talk about here later, of your imagination in this way.
Okay.
And that to me is the difference, is we're looking for something that can be a consistent resource of strength.
Yeah.
That's not going to be affected by someone outside of you or you having to go perform something somewhere. Yeah.
Okay. Gotcha.
Got it.
Yeah. So let's actually go into a little example of Bernard doing this exact thing. Yes. We get to see a little bit of his emotional safe place. Oh,
yes, we do.
Yours.
That's right. One of our favorite lines in here about his emotional safe place. Yeah. So.
Okay. Here it is.
Which unease are you talking about, man? Because I spent about the first 4 years here dealing with all of the uneases. I worked through the fight or flight adrenaline ones first, and then we spent a few months on basic stage fright, and for a while there, I got uneasy in the middle of meditating, like I thought I was meditating wrong, which is technically not possible, but it sure made me uneasy. We worked all on all that stuff, didn't we, James?
What do you mean you worked on that? How do you work on something like that?
Well, I usually talk it over with Gandhi in our perfect weather bubble on top of Mount Everest with a whiteout blizzard blocking out the rest of the world, you know.
Yep. You know how I handle unease? I hop on my purple dragon and soar through high mountain passes. Daredevil kind of stuff, but oddly enough, it calms me down.
Whoa, wait. So, your dragon? What are you talking about? What is this?
Our emotional safe places. We create them in our heads as part of a technique I call strategic therapeutic daydreaming.
Okay, so obviously this is pretty self-explanatory, what you're doing. You're essentially playing make-believe like you would as a kid, right? Like
exactly.
Where you're hiding under a table and like it's you're in a castle all
right.
of a sudden.
Exactly.
You know, and like, exactly. And it's like this whole world that you're imagining in your head
and
really using to your own effect.
Right.
But how exactly, so kids are very good at this.
Mm-hmm.
Adults, not so much.
Yeah.
Right? First off, why do we fall out of that?
Well, so here's the interesting part.
Is that culture or is...
I think some of it is culture and some of it is just it. In childhood, it's a concrete measure. I'm under a table. I think I'm, you know, in a castle. I've got a blanket over it.
Yeah. And it's very real.
Yeah. And I'm making noises like swords
right,
or things,
right.
or, you know, things running. And so I'm there.
Yeah.
Okay. It's the concrete operations of childhood that I can think it and imagine it and I feel like I'm there.
Okay.
In adolescence, you go through a development in what will be called metacognition or the abstract thinking where you can suddenly start thinking before something happens, after it happens, while something's happening. You can imagine and think about things abstractly.
Yeah.
So the imagination goes into this metacognition space of thinking abstractly.
Okay.
And so it actually moves into that tool. And I think people use it in the forms of creativity, brainstorming, trying to conceptualize.
Gotcha.
But I don't really see it used as a resource or as
right.
a powerful tool for mental and emotional health.
Yeah. So it's not that adults don't have this or that less
absolutely
less, you know, there.
It's just not practiced.
It's just not practiced like
correct.
It regularly is as a little kid.
Yeah, it's just not understood. And so you'll hear me talk about it time and time again here is maturing your imagination.
Yeah.
Which is what I think we learn to do. It's actually been the most fascinating aspect of my professional career as a counselor and helping people to use this.
Yeah. So how does one actually do that? How does one go about creating these imaginary worlds in their head and getting back to that space of, you know, being able to think that they're in a castle under a table?
Right.
Something like
that. I guess
that,
you could be in a castle under a table.
I think that'd be great.
Castle's kind of cool.
That'd be awesome.
I never thought about having a castle in my place. Yeah. I could probably go create one tonight. Be careful.
Yeah.
But look, the easiest way to do this, and I certainly explain these concepts in my book, Focus Forward.
Yeah.
And I'm also coming out with my video education series, and one of them is called Strategic Therapeutic daydreaming,
ooh,
which is the idea of daydreaming.
I like that purpose. Term. Yeah,
it's kind of a fun term, isn't it?
Yeah,
strategic therapeutic daydreaming.
Right. It really encompasses exactly what it is.
It is.
Like that. That is. There's nothing more, nothing less that you need there. Yeah.
Right. So there's a whole video education series on that that I'll explain in detail.
Gotcha.
In creating this space, but meaningfully in the easiest ways to do it. I tell people to think about a meaningful or a very nurturing time in their life. They were on vacation. They were on a beach. Mm. They were in, at their grandmother's property, playing up in the backyard in this incredibly old oak tree.
Mm.
Okay. You can take those old memories, mm-hmm. okay, and that's where you can start for a lot of people.
Okay.
I believe I created out of nothing. Can you imagine that?
Mm.
And so, mine now is 32 years old, my emotional safe place in my head. It's quite the, and it continues.
How big is it?
Oh, I think it's...
Is there a measure that you can put on it?
Boy, I never thought about that. I have to give it some thought here by the end, Jules, to see if I can measure my emotional safe place in my mind's eye. That'd be interesting. But you take a place like from vacation or someplace that felt really nurturing.
Yeah.
But I ask people to customize it, meaning put more trees in it, change the color of the sand.
Yeah.
And
make it what they want.
Yeah, make it 84 degrees with a 5 degree northerly breeze blowing in that's just cool enough. So when you customize it like that, you'll hear me talk about it as video editing. You're editing your imagination in a personal way. When you personalize it like that, it becomes customized to you.
Yeah.
It becomes safe. It becomes embedded in your internal sense of self because you've personally done it.
Huh.
And I think that's one of the keys as to why it's easy to go back and remember. Because I created it, nobody else, in my own mind's eye, in the own safety of my imagination.
Right.
Okay? So this is one way to do it.
And that can also kind of get to what we were talking about in the fifth episode of not being able to really connect with your sense of self.
Yes.
That ADHD people have such a hard time with that. And through this method of literally just imagination and creating a space where you can be with yourself and it be okay and everything be okay.
Yep.
That in itself starts to develop that sense of self.
Exactly. And this is where, again, a little bit of a stumble on back in the 90s.
Mm.
That this distress internally and feeling broken and something's wrong with me and can't follow through and stay organized.
Yeah.
The chronic distress, this suddenly became a really powerful way to circumvent or counterbalance or navigate that space.
Yeah.
So the easiest way to do it, take something that's meaningful, make some edits to it so it's personalized.
Gotcha.
I really do think it's important. And if you go look at... in my book or in the video education series coming up,
mm-hmm.
it is really critical to create what's called a secret passageway. And I want to say that real quick.
Yeah.
And that may seem a little odd initially, but it's just a way that I think about getting there.
Okay. Getting into the imagination.
Right. Or into your emotional safe place.
Okay.
I say that because for so many people who have been highly distressed in their life, they don't feel safe even imagining to themselves.
Mm, okay. Wow.
So now I say the number 67. Or I see the color blue around me and I walk into it.
Or it could be like highly, highly complex.
Sure, where it doesn't matter what it is. The key to this is come up with something that's unique to you, but you never tell anybody else.
Yeah.
And when you never tell anyone else...
Not even your closest...
No, no one.
No one.
Then the threat modulator in your mind, your survival instinct, calms down a little further because no one else knows how you get there.
Wow.
So it's a neat little mental gymnastics trick I discovered. And I really like it. And I'm certain it's been in and around the psychological field, treating ADHD with it, particularly the emotional distress syndrome.
Yeah.
I call it a toehold in your emotional sense of safety. And I think... it works beautifully, but I do want to say that as part of creating this kind of meaningful space, that you do create some kind of little secret passageway that you don't tell anybody else because it helps it to keep it safe.
Yeah.
And don't overthink that. You can come up with anything. You can change it the next time you go in.
You can change it whenever you want. Yeah.
It's yours.
Right.
Got it.
Yeah.
Yep. That's it.
Wow. I love that. Yeah. I honestly might use that as a, non-ADHDer. That sounds...
I personally think I have the most cool one, but I won't tell you because it's mine.
Oh, why not? See, that's the thing that you can get into.
Very easily.
Yeah, okay. And so that I think that's really important for the listeners to be aware of,
yeah,
is that if you tell somebody about... Don't tell them that you have a secret passageway.
Right.
Right? Tell them about the emotional safe place, maybe, if you want to.
Yeah, and be really careful with that because that's a really personal sense of safety.
Right, but it can get really iffy if people start pushing and poking about what is actually in there. And like,
funny. Okay, we're gonna have to tell it. It's a funny little story. Okay. Stick with us on this. I tell you, we won't go too far here. But so years ago, my secret passageway was an invisible force field, DNA body recognition related for only me.
Mm.
I had to smile to get through the force field. I created that. And I can tell anyone about it. You're not my DNA. You can't smile like me. You can't get through.
Huh.
One night, I'm kind of bantering with my dear wife about this kind of piece. And we're playing back and forth. Yeah. And she's playing with the idea of kind of how to get in. Exactly. And I went to bed that night and I felt not unsafe, but I went, that's a little weird. I feel like, you know, maybe something could get in there.
Yeah, okay? Right.
I woke up the next morning. I changed the way I got in in my own mind's eye.
Yeah.
Never told anyone else. All the safety returned very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a little mental gymnastics, folks.
Yeah.
So important. Keep it to yourself.
Maintain awareness about it.
Yeah, and if by chance it becomes shiny and you happen to let it slip out to someone else, just change it.
Just change it to something... Maybe more shiny.
Oh, yes. All right.
So we've already kind of talked about what I just want to review a little bit what this provides to the person.
Right.
It provides a sense of security.
Sure.
It provides a sense of self, a beginning of a sense of self.
Yeah, yeah. Kind of a toehold or an internal sense. Yep.
And I guess, why does this work so well?
This is why it works so well. Look, it provides a protection. I also like to think about it almost like an insulation from the emotional stress of ADHD, because we don't know where we're going to hiccup or lack a follow through or say something we didn't mean or forget something. And so it provides this kind of protection to yourself.
Yeah.
But without this internal resource, okay, the default system of our bodies is to go to the survival instinct. The survival instinct fight, flight, or freeze. It really drains our mental and emotional energy. And so this is a vital piece because it doesn't allow you to go to that default system of survival as often.
So, but it really needs to be paired with an awareness of your own emotional state.
Sure.
Right? Because if you don't feel yourself spinning and starting to get into this like emotional distress or into a weird space, then you're not going to know to be able to go to your emotional safe
place. Yeah, well, that's a really good point. But the reality is for us, it can be the look on someone's face. It can be something I forgot. And boy, I'm like spinning in a top in no time.
Yeah, yeah.
So the key there is that you practice thinking about going to your sense of an emotional safe place when you're not distressed, sitting during the day, see an awesome oak tree sitting there, you think about installing it in your safe place. It's a playful thing.
Yeah.
So that when I'm under distress, I start learning how to remember to go there or think about it.
And it becomes more automatic
right
at that point. And so like if you even think about going to your emotional safe place, then boom, you're there.
Yes.
You know.
And remembering that this is resourced or developed.
Yeah.
Out of something that's completely natural, like walking or talking or thinking.
Mm-hmm.
We all have imagination.
Yeah.
Learning how to use it powerfully.
Even
and
if
maturing.
You don't think you're that creative of a person.
Sure.
Right?
And I've had people who don't visualize. That's a really good point. And so some people are much more auditory. They're much more smell oriented. So they'll have smell as their safe place. They're feeling oriented.
Oh, that's
so
interesting.
So they create feelings for their safe place. Then some people don't have visuals for it all.
Okay. So that, well, I'm a very visual person. So I guess it'll be hard for me to really grasp that. But that's, I think that's important to note.
No, but I have had people who are very smell sensitive and that's their strongest sense. So they'll smell flowers and think about the idea of the smell of flowers and the idea. And so that's
so like essentially their safe place would be like one big green room of like, you know, just all the flowers they love.
Or it's a kitchen.
Or it's a kitchen.
Incredible smells. Yeah, exactly.
Full of great foods and all that.
And I've had people who use feelings, like the feeling in their body, and they kind of make it stronger, or they put colors around it.
Could you almost attribute an emotional safe place to a physical thing like in you? So like, so let's say you have like a belt that you wear every day or something like that. Could you attribute your emotional safe place like to the buckle on that belt?
Sure.
Like something like, yeah. I think that'd be really cool. Well, that's all, that almost gets into like fantasy.
I know, it gets into science fiction. Stuff. But here's the piece with that. When you put something of an external measure with your safe place, something happens to that belt,
then it's destroyed.
Yeah, well, it feels like something's affected it.
Gotcha.
But it's not necessarily true, but this is why I think you keep it internal, even if it's in a feeling state.
Okay.
Look, the first rule of imagination, there are no rules.
Yeah. Walt Disney.
Yep. 1934 right said that.
Yeah.
Look what he built.
Yeah.
So use your imagination as a powerful resource, bottom line.
Yeah. Awesome. Okay. Okay. So let's move on from that. I think we've explored it enough. Now let's move on to something that Bernard mentioned in this last episode, which was keys.
Yes.
And it's not his car keys or his house key or whatever, as we kind of learn in that past episode. Mm-hmm. It's keys to his inner world, as he explains.
Yes.
Let's hear him talk a little bit about that before we get into it.
Great.
So here he is.
I knew I'd passed out, but I didn't feel the impact because somehow I floated out of my physical body. I was okay with it, though, not scared or euphoric, just looking down at myself lying in the road with all those broken people. Then I heard a voice.
A voice? What did it say?
It told me to remember where I put my keys.
And did you?
Yeah. But it took a while. You know me. I was looking for the Dalai Lama Technicolor breakthrough, but no. First, I had to go home. Then I had to get real with my family. Then I spent 4 years sitting here with James, working to sort out my keys, unlocking rooms I'd trapped myself in, opening up my emotional safe place, which I didn't even know I had back then, and getting rid of keys that didn't open anything anymore. Man, am I making any sense right now?
Yeah, actually, I totally get it. So it almost seems like Bernard is referencing these keys as like they're almost his ability to self-reflect.
Almost, it's a good way to put it.
Like
it's like a trigger or a marker.
Right. Yeah. It's something that he has found that that gave him insight into himself.
Yes.
It's like a piece of information, a key that gave him insight into himself. Do you find that there's a big issue in ADHD with self-reflection? Is that a big thing that happens? I mean, I feel like that's a big thing that happens with everybody, really.
Sure.
Is that it's hard to have self-reflection because we're always wanting to just look at the things around us. You know?
Well, sure. And so the natural space of self-reflection comes from this metacognition or abstract development in our early adolescence, maturing of the mind.
Yeah.
In thinking like an adult, as we would say. But it's interesting, you would talk about kind of this idea of self-reflection. Bernard in this scene is using his keys as a metaphor.
Mm-hmm.
It's a way for him to remember. It's kind of
it's
a memory
a physical
tag.
Thing that
yeah,
he can
that
use.
That he used. And when you look at it like that, to me, people with ADHD do not have an effective form of self-reflection.
Mm.
See, they do have self-reflection, but unfortunately, the self-reflection is about berating, beating yourself up, voices in your mind.
So that stems from this lack of self, of self-identity almost.
And that the survival instinct is happening too much, and so it's a threat, and it's these kind of negative voices that initially many people will use that kind of, I would say, negative thought or kind of pressure to kind of get something done. Hey, pull yourself up by your bootstraps. Come on, you can just do this.
Do it. Come on.
And that helps to some degree.
Okay.
If it's chronic that you do that, you don't have any other way, you can't calm down from distress, and you're constantly being distressed.
Yeah, then it's a problem.
Then it becomes a problem in that those negative voices, I talk about them in my book, Focus Forward, as being character assassinators. That they really just berate you constantly, that like, I can't believe you just did that. Oh my God, not again.
Yeah.
You're never going to get this right. Sorry to trigger everything off for everybody.
Yeah, right. That's, I'm sure.
That was my intention. Woo! I can feel it. Yep. Relax so a little
go
bit.
Go to your emotional safe place. Like,
I was like, oh, wait, I could feel that
take,
for a minute.
Take some breaths.
Exactly. So look, initially that self-reflection isn't effective generally for most people with ADHD. Okay, what I'm talking about here is the effective form of self-reflection that Bernard does initially is with his therapist, James.
Yeah,
it's a little weird that I'm talking about a character in the podcast that was me, and now I'm talking about it on this podcast.
Right.
It's a little strange, but I like that little dance. But I won't digress any further. Yeah. It's a little strange for me, but it's fun. But that effective form of self-reflection was through therapy, where he really learned things about himself, okay? Where he understood why certain things happened. He emotionally was able to release some things and feel really good about them.
Yeah.
But this form of self-reflection is that this is how it develops the internal strength, okay? In being able to self-reflect on your stories and your history and learn from them, the emotional safe place helps you to kind of underpin or, you know, have strength to be able to do that.
Okay. Yeah. So, I mean, that makes sense. If you're able to create this emotional safe place that allows you to start having a sense of self and also start having a sense of security within yourself, that will allow you the bandwidth to be able to analyze.
It does.
To be able to start figuring things out about why you do something, why you don't do something, you know, like what your motivations are and how to kind of maybe change that for the better if you want to.
Yes. And I also think this internal sense of strength, because there's also a concept that we didn't necessarily go directly to called the mental support group, where you have people in your mind's eye that support you in reaching your greatest self. But it's a way that when you do have lack of follow through or inconsistency, I'm 56, I'm an expert in ADD, I still have storms, I had them less than 24 hours ago, I recover quickly.
Yeah.
But many times it takes these internal resources of like talking to an old friend of mine about what happened and feeling a sense of comfort in my mind's eye of what
let's actually talk about that. What do you mean by a mental support group? Like how, so somebody builds this emotional safe place. How do they now input other people?
Yes. Well, it's impossible.
Because that's what it is, right?
And this is where maybe the ongoing afterthoughts beyond the afterthoughts
happens.
But look, the mental support group is simply much like you're creating an environment of safety in your mind's eye.
Okay.
The mental support group is literally people you would consider that are safe, that would be supportive of you.
Like mentors almost.
Mentors. And the interesting thing is, and this is really, really where I encourage you to go and look at Focus Forward. I describe this much more in detail, that you can use the community at large, people living or dead. It doesn't matter. It's more the concept.
Does it have to be somebody that you know?
Nope. Nope. In fact, in my book, I reference Deepak Chopra. I've shook his hand. I've owned most of his books. I love his work. Absolutely love his mindful meditation guided CDs with Oprah. They're really, really good, folks. It's a great inspiration, science, mantra. It's a really good reflection. But I've had Deepak Chopra in my mind's eye for over 20 years.
Wow.
We've had some storied conversations in my mind's eye. Now, get this right, I am having a conversation with myself.
Right.
Through the self-reflection of how I would see he would support me. Because I do much of the same he does in helping people reach their greatest sense of self or are finding different degrees of health. So I know he would support what I do.
Yeah.
And boy, one day if I ever meet him in person, it'll be fun saying, hey, Deepak, you've been in my head for a long time.
Yeah, I mean that, well, I feel like you have to be a little bit careful with that because that can come off very creepy in some sense.
Unless you understand the science of imagination.
Right.
Okay? Because he is an enormously storied person who has helped millions of people feel good about themselves. And so my idea of someone like Deepak Chopra really supporting me in my development, I just know that it's a strong resource within myself. And it's a mental gymnastics of self-reflection to develop the relationship with myself.
Gotcha.
And I'm telling you...
So it's just it's another creative strategy in order to jump around these hoops that...
Yep, and I'm going to go through much of this again in my video education series on strategic therapeutic daydreaming. Yeah. So I really want people to understand them because they are powerful resources.
Right, yeah.
So...
Yeah, it definitely is. Well, yeah, is there anything else you want to add in?
Well, I think, you know, how does it help to unlock these inner doors you were talking about? How do you unlock them?
Well, I mean, that's, yeah, I guess that's kind of, I guess that's a good question.
Well, the reason I say that is that using the emotional safe place.
Well, so I'm actually kind of confused. So what are these doors?
Good question.
You know, like,
so these doors are patterns of disruption, events that have happened to you that you don't want to think about, that are holding some mental distress of how you don't feel good about yourself, or your lack of follow through in school time and time again, or interrupting people, or having gotten fired from a job.
So it's distresses.
Yeah. If they're going to be, generally, when you talk about unlocking doors you don't want to open, they're generally stresses back there.
Well, now, they're usually locked because you don't want to open them.
Sure. And the reality is, in the science of the mind, that is trapping mental energy by default. So it takes some mental energy to kind of keep that door locked.
Yeah.
Okay?
Right.
It's mostly behind the scenes. Many people don't even realize they're doing it sometimes. Sometimes they do. But the reality is, creating an emotional safe place allows you to self-reflect and observe effectively, ponder, like I said, even have a dialogue with yourself, talk with someone in your own mind's eye to kind of talk these things out. And you may have initially done this in therapy, like Bernard did with me at the complex. But the unlocking of the doors happens when you have insight about what happened, when you release the emotions that were trapped in those histories, when you no longer see the door as being locked, it's not a problem in my life.
You can willingly open it and go through and,
well, it's an access to a powerful resource, Jules. And it really leads me to the other subtitle to my practice. My main subtitle is that I create lifelong strategies for success.
Yeah.
Personalizing them is very effective.
Yeah.
The other subtitle to my practice is that I live both professionally and personally. Your entire life history is your most valuable resource that can be read like a rich storybook time and time again for experience, strength, hope, wisdom, knowledge. You want to be able to reference it. If you have doors locked and you can't talk about things, then you lose mental and emotional energy, and that is just tragic.
And you're also losing opportunity to learn and to grow.
And this is where families are affected by this, who get distressed. Then they start keeping doors locked in themselves. Professionals treating it who don't understand it at a deeper level feel frustrated with their clients. And so I really like that in episode 6 here, we've really unlocked, pun intended, I guess, the use of imagination and how powerful it is.
Yeah. So how can somebody use, I guess you were kind of talking about that they can discuss these things that they don't necessarily, like if somebody doesn't want to go to therapy, for instance, if somebody doesn't want to talk about these locked doors, they can have a discussion with somebody in their emotional safe place.
They can.
to get started on that.
To start, sure, you know. and to feel a sense of relaxation or a sense of support.
Mm.
Okay. And many people keep journals. There are many, many effective ways of journaling kind of to yourself or to a higher self or a God or whatever people want to call that kind of space. But using these internal worlds to reference those kind of histories and forgive or understand or have compassion.
Yeah.
There's some really, really good self-compassion mindful meditations out there, guided meditations. There's a woman named Christian Neff, N-E-F-F.
Okay.
She's a professor at the University of Texas, actually, who's done really seminal work around self-compassion, guided meditations.
Yeah.
But this is how you build that relationship with yourself stronger.
Is there a point where somebody will know that they've successfully unlocked a door? Like, is there a feeling that...
The feeling state is you don't have as much fear around it. You're not as embarrassed. You're not as anxious.
You're accepting of it.
And you begin to learn from it.
Yeah.
And so one of the quickest ways to unlock a door or to look at histories like that have happened is really to ask yourself, what did I learn from this?
Mm.
Who am I now? What strengths have I taken?
Yeah.
What wisdom have I taken to impart on others in my life?
Yeah.
But that can give you a framework to kind of walk through some of these things.
Yeah.
But let's make no mistake.
Yeah.
The emotional distress syndrome of ADHD, I believe, is the most serious issue with this diagnosis that's not being well managed or talked about. And I'm really on a major hunt to really help other therapists and people understand how to manage it.
Yeah.
And so it does take professional help or talking with others, talking about pods of support.
Yeah.
There's some really, really good groups out there. And so if this kind of self-reflection becomes too difficult for yourself, you know, this is what good friends are for and those kind of things, support groups. But you can really get to a better place in your life.
Yeah. Yeah. And you don't have to sit in this distress
for the rest of your life. No, you absolutely do not.
There are strategies and ways and techniques and people who are there to help and who can help.
Yes. Yeah. And as a recent person said to me, look, you crack the code on the emotional distress of this condition. It's a Pandora's kind of box.
Yeah.
And I'm telling you, I'm a single person in South Austin, Texas, and I'm doing as much as I can to get my information out. I have my first group of 10 therapists in training and learning my concepts about how to do this. I plan to bring that out more to other folks on trainings, day-long trainings around the world. For those who are interested, those things will be coming up here in the near future.
Awesome. Well, I can't wait for it, and I think a lot of the audience can't wait for it as well.
Well, who knows what happens after these afterthoughts?
Yeah, well, we will see. Stay tuned, of course.
Stay tuned. Oh, this has been so much fun, Jules.
Yes,
I can't tell you.
It has.
Having you certainly as my son and done this professional product with me, it's really a dream come true, and I want people to hear that. So I really appreciate all your help with this in so many ways.
Well, it's been a lot of fun, and I couldn't have done it without your extensive knowledge about ADHD.
Yes,
so
it's totally cool. And here comes a high five. Thank
nice.
You. I really appreciate
that. Was a good high five.
It was a good high five.
Yeah. Okay. Well, while we thank each other, I also want to thank everyone listening to this podcast.
Oh, yeah, there's other people here too.
Because they are the ones that really made this what it is, and really pushed us forward in wanting to do it. So thank you for listening and following the creation of this whole masterpiece that we've done and tried to, you know, make into some sort of tangible thing. If you haven't already, please share these episodes with anyone you think might find it useful. We really want to get this information out, like James was saying, to as many people.
Please put it on your social media, on your Instagram, on your all your Twitter accounts.
Yeah.
Push this out, because I think it's really, I built this as a fun resource to really help people diagnosed with ADHD, their families and professionals.
Yeah, to get them started on this path of knowing that they don't have to sit in this distress for the rest of their life.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
If you want to learn more about the concepts that James has been talking about, obviously you can go get his video education series coming out this May. And then you can also find his book Focused Forward, all of which is on his website at www.jamesochoa.com. All right. Well, thanks for listening, everyone. And I hope you have a wonderful rest of your day.